In a recent important article, Surveillance Blowback, The Making of the U.S. Surveillance State, 1898 to 2020, Professor Alfred McCoy brings us up to date on how and why we are facing the most massive surveillance state in the history of our country. This critical article helps us understand the context of the leaked NSA documents by whistleblower Ed Snowden. Professor McCoy details the surveillance timeline beginning with the U.S. occupation of the Philippines in 1898 and makes the connection to U.S. imperialism abroad and the blowback that imperialism and surveillance state abroad has on our own lives here in the United States. We've had Professor McCoy on this show before, particularly around torture. His important work, The Question of Torture, was perhaps the best book on the Bush's administration and later Obama's administration involvement in torture.
Professor McCoy, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be back.
For many Americans, the recent Snowden revelations about spying came as a surprise, but you've been involved in chronicling really a timeline of U.S. spying starting back in 1898. Can you talk a bit about our occupation of the Philippines and what happened?
Sure. First of all, 4 years ago, I published a book called Policing America's Empire, which started in the Philippines and traced the history of U.S. domestic surveillance through what I call surveillance blowback. And writing publicly in 2009, I said the country was just a few tweaks away through this process of sort of surveillance blowback from our foreign operations, from establishing a domestic surveillance state.
You requote that in this article, and it's an incredible quote. I put a big star by it. And what you say exactly is, the war on terror has, quote, proven remarkably effective in building a technological template that could be just a few tweaks away from creating a domestic surveillance state, with omnipresent cameras, deep data mining, nanosecond biometric identification, and drone aircraft patrolling the homeland. You said that 4 years ago. I just want to emphasize your Cassandra-like nature.
Yeah, I know. It's the trajectory of history that allows you to see this. Whereas when you study history, you can't see the fine-grained details, but the overarching trends do emerge. And let me explain what happened, okay? In the late 19th century, America had what I call our first information regime, which was really a brilliant synergy of discoveries. Thomas Edison's quadruplex telegraph, Philo Remington's typewriter, allowed the transmission around the world and across the United States of data absolutely accurately at the rate of 40 words a minute. In the state of Massachusetts, Melville Dewey, an obscure librarian at Amherst College, invented something called the Dewey Decimal System. But what it was he discovered the smart number, the alphanumeric code that not only put things in order like 1, 2, 3, 4, but also indicated content. And this allowed potentially the filing of limitless amounts of data and, of course, the cross-filing, something you have to do for any kind of effective surveillance and following of human beings. And finally, in 1889, an engineer named Herman Hollerith invented the punch card, and he also invented the electric tabulating machine. And in 1890, the U.S. Census Bureau used the machine to enumerate 62 million Americans in the matter of weeks, which stunned the nation and led to the founding of the International Business Machines Corporation, known as IBM.
Yeah, I read the article where you summarized these. Yeah. I thought that last fact was the most astounding. Who would have ever imagined in the 1890s that with a punch card system they could process 62 million Americans?
It was done in weeks. It was amazing. And it wasn't just counting them. It was enumerating all the data on those punch card census forms. But although the United States had, if you will, all the technological components of a surveillance state, the last thing we had, of course, was we had something that the Gainwell Corporation for a half century during the 19th century was the world leader in the development of police telegraph and telephone communications, those police boxes that used to be on the streets of every American city. Gainwell Corporation had 900 of these systems in operation across the United States, and collectively they sent 41 million messages in the year 1900. Well, we had all that potential, but the federal government was in the United States an extraordinarily weak apparatus. It effectively had, as of our intervention in the Philippines in 1898, the U.S. federal government had no domestic law enforcement or internal security capacity really much beyond the customs barrier, all right? And so when we intervened in the Philippines, we were suddenly faced with this massive insurgency, this guerrilla underground, and we smashed the regular military formations, but we couldn't break the insurgency. And so the U.S. Army, in order to pacify that country, created the first field intelligence unit in its 100-year history, and it appointed an obscure medical doctor named Captain Ralph Van Diemen to be the head of the Division of Military Information. It turned out he had a natural flair for intelligence, and he decided that he would map the entire Filipino political elite, and he developed information cards documenting physical appearance, real property, kinship relations, political affiliations, place of residence, an amazing amount of information. William Howard Taft, later President of the United States, passed very draconian sedition and libel legislation and created a powerful colonial secret police called the Philippines Constabulary. And together he had, for the day, a near total control over information. And what he developed was a system for suppressing scandal about allies and releasing incriminating information about political enemies.
This was all in the Philippines?
This was all in the Philippines, and this combination of this system, the U.S. Army Division of Military Information under Captain Van Diemen and William Howard Taft's combination of repressive, almost draconian legislation, and this colonial secret police pacified the Philippines.
This is early 1900s, right?
Between 1898 and 1907, when the operation was finally over. It took about 10 years to accomplish. Because the Philippines had the first national revolution in Asia. They had fielded an army. They defeated Spanish colonial rule when we intervened. So we had to undo that, not only defeat the army and track down the guerrillas. We had to track down the politicians. We had to penetrate them. We had to manipulate them. We had to politically demobilize a mobilized society, a society that launched Asia's first national revolution. Okay, well, 10 years after that process was completed in 1917, World War One, the United States joined World War One. At the time we entered the war in April of 1917, the United States had the only army on either side of the battlefield that didn't have an intelligence service of any description. We had no U.S. military intelligence. So we turned to now Colonel Van Diemen, who applied his Philippine experience to developing a very elaborate counterintelligence apparatus inside the United States. He's now known as the father of U.S. military intelligence, and he established something called the Military Intelligence Division, and he amplified his power. He started off with one employee himself. He had, by the end of the war, 1,700 employees. But more importantly, he formed an alliance with something called the American Protective League, which was an empowered series of vigilantes that carried badges, and they did domestic gumshoe surveillance. And through this, they compiled, my estimate is something like 1 million pages of type reports, mainly on German and Italian Americans, because those were our enemies in the war. And I was worried about sort of fifth column subversion in the United States. And then after the war, Van Diemen's Military Intelligence Division joined with the FBI, all right, and they launched a campaign against the left, the famous or notorious Luster raids in New York City, the Palmer raids across northeastern part of the United States, and counterintelligence operations against the Wobblies, the industrial workers of the world, all the way from New York City to Seattle. And the second thing that happened, which is very important, is that this was all done by an American Democratic liberal, that great American liberal president, Woodrow Wilson. Well, when the Republicans came into office in 1921, they were at that day all conservative privacy advocates. So the U.S. Attorney General, Harlan Fiske Stone, denounced what he called the dangers of a secret police. He forced the FBI to cut back all its ties to these patriotic vigilante organizations. And 5 years later, the Republican Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, abolished the cipher section of the Military Intelligence Division with his famous statement, "Gentlemen do not read each other's mail." And they ratcheted it right back. But nonetheless, the apparatus remained in place. And during the 1960s, during the Vietnam War, the FBI launched the notorious counterintelligence program using these same techniques that Van Diemen had developed during World War I in collaboration with the FBI, and they unleashed them on the African-American civil rights movement and on the anti-Vietnam protest movement and launched something like 2,300 dangerous and potentially violent counterintelligence operations under the COINTEL program against the anti-war left. And this whole thing came into public view in the mid-1970s. Seymour Hersh, then reporting for the New York Times, discovered that the CIA, violating its charter, was conducting domestic surveillance of the anti-war movement. The Church Committee began investigating, and the upshot of this all was, in a cruel irony, in 1978, President Carter created the FISA courts, which required the FISA court issue a warrant for wiretapping or surveillance, and thus bring to an end the illegal surveillance done by both CIA and FBI during the 60s and early 1970s.
We're talking about military intelligence spying on individuals. Doesn't that run counter to the Army should not be spying on civilians?
Yeah, but under the pressures of World War I, nobody raised that issue. You know, the Van Diemen's, you know, the U.S. Army, of course, as we all know, was fighting the Western Front in Europe, right? There were no combat operations in the United States. So Van Diemen's entire military intelligence division was, in fact, a domestic counterintelligence operation. There was no apparent concern. That was, I think, that sense that the military should stay out of domestic affairs, but more importantly, that privacy should be protected.
Let me go back for a second on that.
Sure.
You go from setting up of the whole operation during World War I under Wilson, et cetera, coming back to the United States at the same time and the work with the Protective League. And then the Republicans take office and they begin to roll it back. And then you go to Vietnam. And I know in your piece, of course, you talk about some of what happened in the interim, the anti-communist days, that was Hoover. So there's something going on here that in between the rollback from Wilson and then COINTELPRO. And can you just talk about that for a minute?
Well, sure. There are two things that happened. First of all, during the interwar period, really during the 1930s, the federal government had a very limited domestic surveillance. The FBI mainly concentrated during that period on being gangbusters, going after Pretty Boy Floyd and the bank robbers and all that sort of stuff. They focused the Bureau's resources on fighting, not so much mafia, but these spectacular kind of banditti, the independent bank robbers. And they stayed pretty much out of the domestic security and intelligence game because they've been cut back during the 1920s. During that period, when Van Diemen retired from the U.S. military with the rank of Major General in 1929, he moved into a comfortable bungalow with his wife, who was quite a formidable woman. She was the first woman in the world to fly on an aircraft. And together, retired General and Mrs. Van Diemen ran a kind of private intelligence service that had Army file clerks and regular FBI liaison officers dropping by. And from their home, they compiled files on 250,000 suspected subversives. And they ran a kind of informal intelligence exchange between the Office of Naval Intelligence, U.S. Army Military Intelligence Division, and then the notorious Red Squads in the San Diego and the Los Angeles police. And the Los Angeles police Red Squad was absolutely notorious in the 1930s for its abuse of due process and of civil liberties. And they descended, actually, into shakedowns and assassination attempts on each other that finally led to their abolition. And then the Better Business Bureaus in Los Angeles and cities across the United States also had their own anti-Red intelligence squads that did investigations of radicals and suspected communist agitators. And then on the factory floors of industrial America, plant security also did counterintelligence work trying to ferret out the union organizers. So it was effectively kind of a privatized system of intelligence during the interwar period that operated. And Van Diemen was at the epicenter of that. He also served an informal function of moving classified reports from government files into the hand of citizen vigilantes. And it's believed that the New York Times, when they conducted an investigation in 1971 of Van Diemen and his network and his files, when they finally surfaced, it's believed that Van Diemen may have provided the the allegations that Congresswoman Helen Gehagan Douglas was a pinko, was a commie, and therefore at Nixon rallies when he ran against Congresswoman Helen Gehagan Douglas for the U.S. Senate in 1950, Nixon disseminated the so-called pink sheets, tarring Helen Gehagan Douglas with the accusations of communism. It was believed that the Van Diemen files were the source of those allegations against her. But then in 1940, as war was starting, suddenly we began to expand both our foreign intelligence and our domestic counterintelligence. And in Washington, D.C., there was something called the closed-door delimitation conference, in which U.S. Army intelligence and FBI met at the direction of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And Van Diemen, although he was retired, attended there, and they divided the world. Basically, the North American, the Americas, North America and Latin America, became the purview of the FBI for counterintelligence, and the rest of the world became the purview of U.S. military intelligence, and then, of course, its successors, Office of Strategic Services, the CIA, and then the NSA. So that division of the world remained in effect until September 2011.
A couple of things struck me in the article, as you pointed out, that what we do abroad and the way we particularly began to go after people in the Philippines who were leading it away from the United States, and the surveillance we did then blew back on us. And throughout your whole piece, that's at least one of the key theories. And so now we come to 9/11 and, of course, the beginning of a massive surveillance state and George Bush and then Obama's role. So can you give us some sense of how that's set up and where we are today? And, of course, when I looked at your piece, I said, well, there was a rollback each time after the worst of it. This time there doesn't seem to be such a rollback. So let's talk about that.
The sophisticated surveillance apparatus comes home from the Philippines. It's developed in 1898-1907. It comes back in 1917. It elaborates into a massive counterintelligence surveillance apparatus across the United States, arguably the most intensive anywhere in the world to date. But then during the 1920s, it gets pulled back. Again, during the Vietnam eras, the combination of intelligence operations overseas in Vietnam and domestic counterintelligence produce is a proliferation of counterintelligence operations in the United States. Again, when the war is over in the late 1970s, 1978, through the investigation by Congress and the FISA reforms and internal bureaucratic reforms inside the CIA and FBI, it all gets cut back, just like it did in the 1920s, okay? Well, now we're seeing the same process, except with a difference, okay? After 9/11, the United States plunged into two complex wars, very similar to the way they did in 1898 in the Philippines. Iraqi and Afghan society are very dense, complex social formations. We plunged right into both. We had very limited, in fact, almost no intelligence on either society, no expertise, and we suddenly found ourselves facing massive insurgency, a Sunni insurgency in Iraq and a Taliban insurgency in Afghanistan, and the situation is blowing right out of control. You know, everybody thinks that the surge in 2007 under President Bush capped the situation, but that's apparently not the case. What happened was that, again, we had a kind of revolution in American intelligence, and we developed two fundamental techniques. First of all, under General McChrystal, the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, developed very sophisticated techniques for amassing all of the electronic and human intelligence on suspected al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorists, and then launched a very efficient operation under Special Operations Forces and drones to assassinate, to systematically knock off these targets. And it's believed that, Woodward made the argument in his book on this period, on the surge, that it's really JSOC and the assassinations that turned the tide. Second thing that we did was we applied a very sophisticated digital identification, biometric identification techniques, starting the Battle of Fallujah and then for the pacification of Baghdad. We compiled files of 3 million iris scans, retina scans, on Iraqis. These could be accessed by checkpoints and soldiers, U.S. soldiers on patrol.
That was an amazing fact to me when I read it, that you're going on a patrol, the soldier has a little handheld computer.
A camera with a wireless connection, and all you do is you reach forward and you just put your fingers, right, like a open up the eye and you take a shot, and this is it has to be a very high-quality digital camera. It turns out the iris has millions of unique biometric identifications encoded. And in 2000, a researcher at Cambridge University worked out a way of codifying the individual biometrics of every individual's iris. It's far more accurate and far easier to capture than a fingerprint. And these are then all these 3 million iris, retina, and fingerprints are housed in a mainframe computer in West Virginia. So the soldier could flick that digitally via satellite communication in West Virginia and get a confirmation. Is this Iraqi supposed to be on this street in this neighborhood? If not, take him in.
Amazing.
And you can go online. You can Google. If you Google iris scan Afghanistan, you'll get hundreds, now thousands of photographs of U.S. soldiers, you know, taking pictures of Afghani eyeballs, okay? And we've now got field teams in Afghanistan that do the same thing, although we're winding that back. So what we developed then was this very efficient system of surveillance and digital monitoring overseas. During the war on terror, we now know that the Bush administration, beginning in October 2001, authorized the NSA to start massive tapping of all digital communications, initially under the pretext of searching for foreigners, but gradually that barrier was thrown out, and we just began this massive data mining in collaboration with the British intelligence and indeed with the Five Eyes network that includes Britain, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States. And in March of this year, it was 97 billion emails that were tapped by the NSA. So, in other words, what we're watching is that, okay, there was this massive expansion of very sophisticated electronic eavesdropping and biometric identification overseas, all right? And then during the war on terror, we didn't have to wait for a lag. This began migrating homeward very, very quickly through the NSA wiretapping of all fiber optic cables that are transmitting this data internationally in the United States. But the difference in the past, okay, is that the old partisan check on the establishment of a standing permanent surveillance state broke down. In other words, Bush did this, and we know that he did it illegally. Okay, the New York Times in 2005 had an amazing expose of Bush's illegal wiretapping, and Congress legitimated that in 2007 with the Protect America Act. They immunized the administration from their illegality. But when Obama came in, even though he criticized this illegal wiretapping as a senator and as a candidate, when he came in, instead of cutting it back as the Republicans had done in the 1920s and as the Democrats did in the 1970s, he's decided to build upon it. And what he's building upon it for, I think, is to build an architecture for the exercise of global power through a significant edge or advantage in information control and information warfare.
Al, I want you to stay on that for a second, because I thought that was one of the most important lines you wrote in the article, as you just said. And say that again, and then you talk about a 14% cutback in U.S. troops, and you put the two together.
Sure. Obama, in his 2012 budget, cut back the infantry by 14%. He's cutting back all the conventional forces. He wants to cut back on the appropriations for the big BMS, the massive artillery, the heavy tanks, the big ships, and all that. And he wants to shift us into an agile form of information warfare and global information control. So what we've seen, for example, is at the same time that he's being cut back, the National Security Administration is spending $1.6 billion to build the world's biggest data farm in Bluffdale, Utah. The National Geospatial Intelligence Agency has a nearly $2 billion headquarters with 16,000 employees recently established in Washington, D.C. The Obama administration has launched a new generation of light, low-cost, very agile satellites that are now actually can be remotely controlled from the ground and are serving ground force commanders in Central Command in Afghanistan, allowing them to use satellites for on-ground intelligence. The Obama administration is also building an armada of 99 Global Hawk drones with 24-hour flight capacity, And these aren't drones for, you know, firing missiles like the Reaper and the Predator. Now, these are basically surveillance drones that have a 100-mile ambit for sucking up audio communications. And so I think what we're looking at is, okay, you got the NSA in collaboration with British intelligence, British Signals Intelligence, GCHQ, tapping the world's fiber optic cables. And as I said in March, 97 billion messages intercepted. At the same time, we're launching this fleet of Global Hawk drones. They can get all those localized two-way communications that are radio transmitted that are not necessarily going to hit the global fiber optic networks. And the combination of the drone surveillance, and mind you, there's a network of about 50 bases ringing the Eurasian landmass to launch these drones. So the combination of drones sucking up the localized two-way radio or cell phone communications in localized systems with the tapping of the fiber optic cables within the United States by the NSA, and then internationally by allies in the Five Eyes coalition, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and Britain, means that the NSA will have virtually a total global surveillance system for the first time in human history. It's an extraordinary moment, and the power that potentially gives the United States for the perpetuation of global hegemony is really quite extraordinary.
How do we have the capacity to effectively analyze and use this kind of level of surveillance and data?
Well, we're getting into an area we don't know very much about, because this is, you know, if there's anything that's secret, it's this sort of stuff. But in 2006, the Bush administration launched a project to harness the IBM Watson series of supercomputers, okay, and apply them to the task of crunching this data. Remember, there was this kind of, you know, supercomputer game, who could build the biggest one, and we had it for a while. The Chinese built the Tianhe 1, and they surpassed us in supercomputing capacity. And it seemed to be one of these games like, you know, what's going on here? I mean, is it like the tallest building? Is that really, you know, efficient real estate? You know, it sort of seems silly. But suddenly, we can see the point of this. Because if you're going to suck up 97 billion messages in a single month and warehouse them, they're pointless unless you can process them. Well, we've apparently applied the supercomputing to this successfully so that we can actually operationalize this massive amounts of data that we're sucking up. And, of course, once it gets operationalized, one of the things we have to deal with, of course, is that this stuff always gets used. You know, you always wind up sucking up not only the routine data, okay, because you don't really care about what ordinary people are doing, all right, but what you'll get is also some strategic intelligence of the kind that we learned about in the WikiLeaks, the 241,000 U.S. diplomatic cables. You get the dirt. You get the sexual and financial malfeasance by world leaders, and that gives you information that you can use to amplify your leverage in that global poker game called diplomacy.
Where do we tell listeners to get your article? What's the website?
The website, the article is out. It's called Surveillance Blowback, and it's on Tom Dispatch, which if you just type in Tom Dispatch, you'll get, and my name, you'll get the article. And second, my book's name is Policing America's Empire, and it's published by University of Wisconsin Press. The subtitle is The United States, the Philippines, and the Rise of the Surveillance State.
Well, thank you, Professor Al McCoy. You always have actually almost the only really new and amazingly prescient look at what's going on in this country and abroad. So thank you.
Thank you.
Wonderful talking. Heidi, wonderful talking.